Last week we started in chapter 4, which starts out with this great question of what is the source of the quarrels and conflicts that are among you? I know that we've all been involved in quarrels and conflicts, both at home and families and church and work, and it just seems to be one of those conditions of human life. And yet, it's an untenable, unlikable situation. Well, I can't say nobody. I have known a few people that really liked to argue and quarrel about things. At least that seemed to be the case. But in general, it's not something that we really want in our lives. And so James asks a very good question here, and he says, okay, where's that all that coming from? And where it's coming from, it says, the source is your own desires, your own lusts, your own internals, really. And then he goes about saying, you really need to understand that this friendship with the world, this relationship that we have with the world that can cause a lot of these things, does not help us with our life towards God. It says it's hostility to God. And so we talked about last week the attitude change that he says, where he says you need to submit to God, resist the devil, draw near to God, and be in that frame, fixing yourself to be able to get rid of all of these. You've heard the expression, it takes two, right? So it's very difficult for someone to sustain an argument if one person isn't. Now, some people are very good at it. We've known people that can do that very well. But in general, working on yourself is the best you can do. But he also says that we got these relationships, and especially as he's talking to Christians in the church. And so I wanted to talk about that for just a few minutes this morning. He begins there down in verse 11. Where he says, do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? So, in this getting rid of the conflicts, we work on ourselves. But then I think there's this relationship piece there. And he says, we're not to judge one another. Now, that's an interesting statement. And in many cases, there's all kinds of ways we can look at that. And then even in Matthew 7 is probably one of the most memorable verses about that, right? Matthew 7, what does he say there? Okay, do not judge lest you be judged. But is that where it stops? I mean, we like to quote that one, and that's what everybody likes to, you know, we just stop right there. What's it say next? It says, in the way that you judge, you will be judged. Okay, that's the scary part. Because he really is talking about there, he says, the whole point is, are there times when you have to make judgments? If you go on down, one of the next things he talks about is, don't throw your pearls before swine. That's always been a kind of a strange one to think about, right? But that makes the fact that you've got to recognize the difference there and understand what it means for what is the whole concept of somebody being in the herd of swine. Mark gave us a lesson on all being sheep. I think we'd all rather be sheep than swine. But the point there is that you still have to make some of these judgments, but understand that how you judge others makes a difference. And so when James is talking about it, he says that if you judge someone else, you become a judge of the law. And I think that really is very similar to what Jesus was saying when he said, judge not that you be not judged, because in the way that you judge, you will be judged. And he says, you judge the law. How is it that you judge the law? And what law do you think he's talking about there? Okay, in particular?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at Matthew chapter 7, pretty much the whole chapter, you're asked to make judgments, not even just the pearls before swine, but you're judging whether or not you're on the narrow way or the wide way. You're judging the fruits there in that same chapter.
Sure. There's always times when we have to weigh and evaluate and understand, especially for ourselves, what we're doing. And a lot of that is what Matthew 7 is dealing with. But even when we're looking at others, we have to be very careful about how we do that. Because he says, how can you remove a speck from your brother's eye if you've got your own vision completely clogged up? And so that self-assessment has to come first. And be very careful then, because we know we all have our own faults as we start looking at other people. And James says, as we start judging these other Christians, he says, then you become a judge of the law. Well, I kind of think he's got the same thing in mind. Go back in James, the second chapter, when he's in verse 8 there. Somebody read that for me. What does it say? James 2, 8. Go ahead. Okay. And he's referred to this sort of royal law a couple of times, and that one in particular. What does he say is the baseline law as he is dealing with this relationship among Christians? Love your neighbor as yourself. That's one of the reasons that we're looking at that this year. There's a lot that's involved there. And he's saying, if that is your foundation, if that's where you start, then does that not change how you interact with people and how you're likely to judge them? So the love has to come first, and we have to understand the motivation for the judgment. He says, otherwise, what happens? You're judging the law. You're saying that that law, love your neighbors yourself, doesn't really matter. And he said, now, who are we to do that? Do you see what he's saying there? If you're judging unrighteously, then you're saying that that law that was laid down doesn't matter. Well, who's the only one that's really able to judge the law? There's only one lawgiver, only one judge. And so unless we are in line with the way that the law is set down by our Lord, then our judgments cannot and will not be correct. So that's where he's kind of making sure that we understand how that relationship works. Yeah, absolutely. And that whole principle has been from the beginning, was it not? I mean, God tried to get that across even in the when he was appointing kings. You know, the people picked Saul, and what did they want him to look like? Want him to look like a king, right? You know, a big guy and strapping, good soldier, all of those kinds of things. And when it came time to pick the next one, what was the statement that God made? You judge by the heart, not by appearances. And that's a little hard for us to do. Why? Really hard for us to see inside the heart, right? And that's one of the things I think we really have to keep in mind is, as we're judging people, sometimes we don't understand all of the motives or all of the circumstances and all of the things. And so a rush to judgment can quite often be wrong and misjudge someone. So James is saying you really need to be careful with this, because that's just going to cause conflicts. And if what we're trying to do is keep the conflicts down, then we need to be careful on how we judge. Now, there's another reason that we really need to be concerned, not only with our relationship with each other for keeping conflicts down and understanding how to work together. How did Jesus say that people would know his people? How they loved one another. So when that breaks down, if the world looks at it and says those can't be God's people, I have this feeling that they're kind of right. Right? If the world looks at it and says, I can see by their actions and by their relationships that that's just not the way God wanted people to do, then we need to be concerned that maybe we're not being God's people. And so this relationship problem here is one that James wants everybody to work on. I love the 1 Peter 8, and I've preached on it here before. If you turn over there with me, he's just quoting Psalms 34, but Peter, Peter's a little book, and so it always slips past my fingers when I'm trying to turn to it. There we go. 1 Peter 2. He's quoting an Old Testament passage here, but where is he? Ah, okay. I'm sorry. I had a different reference. But 1 Peter 2, beginning verse 1. Therefore, putting aside all malice, all deceit, all hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn babes, long for the pure milk of the word, so that by it you may grow in respect to salvation. That's one of the places that he's saying, if you got that whole list there, slander winds up being mentioned over and over again. What is slander? False accusation, right? Why is it mentioned so many times, you think, in this, and by Paul and by Peter and James and others? It's so easy to criticize other people, is it not? And I, you know, good part of the time, a lot of times the criticism's not based on really all of the facts and all of the knowledge and things. And so you wind up with this whole slander problem. And obviously, if these dealing with it a lot in all of these books in Rome and in Corinth, and Peter's talking about it and others, it's still a problem back then. Luckily, it was only a first century problem, right? It's a human problem, and it's still a problem for us, and that's something that we need to really be working on. Now, I also find it interesting that this follows right on the heels of this big section that we covered a couple of weeks ago on the tongue. So he's now going into some details on some of the things that the tongue can get you in trouble on. And this whole idea of slander or false accusation or judging your brother is one of them. It's 1 Peter 3 and verse 8 is the one that I was looking for earlier. To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead, for you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. For the one who desires life, to love and see good days, must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now, I love the way that opens, because who doesn't want to love life and see good days? Do you want to do that? Does that seem like a reasonable goal? Then how are you going to do it? Simple instructions there. Keep your tongue from evil. That's first one of the first ones he lists, right? And so from a practical standpoint, James is writing, really getting down to the, let's get down to what really matters in our relationships with one another. A lot of it is in the communication, how we talk to one another, how we treat one another, based first on our own attitudes. So work on ourselves first, and work on that relationship with each other. So, what are the sources of quarrels and conflicts? In short, it's us, right? We're the problem. It's not the law. It's not what God has given us. We're the problem. And so we can work on it, and it's something he says we need to work on. Okay, any questions on that section? As we move on then, that last section, beginning in verse 13 of James 4, really starts dealing with this whole pursuit of wealth. This is another familiar passage. He says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, and engage in business and make a profit. Yet, you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But, as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin." Okay. This whole concept of the brevity of life is something that I think we begin to understand more and more as we get older. And there's a time in your life when I always judged it by how long does it take to get from one Christmas to the next Christmas? Okay? When you were 3, 4, 5, how long was that? Forever, right? And then when you're a teenager, it's, yeah, okay, it takes a while, it, you know, a year, you got to school year, all of that kind of stuff. For those of us who are kind of in my age bracket, around about there. How long does it take to get from one Christmas to the next now? Huh? It's, you know, we just finished it, and it's almost here again. And you just see this time contraction thing, and then you look back, and Debbie and I, we have a screensaver where we sometimes sit on the couch and watch these pictures roll by. Places we've been, we've got them all stuck on there, and it's just kind of fun because it's a guessing game. You know, where was that? Where was that? But then when you start saying, when was that? Some of you start looking and going, oh my goodness, that was a while ago, wasn't it? There's been a lot of water under that bridge. And that's just kind of life. There are times when it's slow and times when it's fast, but it just keeps moving on. And the whole idea is, all of a sudden, it's done. And it's done. Well, he says, that's your life. That's your life. Now, what are you going to do with your life? Well, he's saying there's a lot of people here, and we have to be careful how we do this, how we look at these verses. He says, you who say, today or tomorrow we're going to go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Now, anything wrong with that? Well, he goes on down and explains that statement by itself may be neither right nor wrong. What makes it right or wrong? Okay, whether you take God with you. A lot of it, again, has to deal with this whole attitude thing, doesn't it? Because he says, instead of saying that, what should you say? If the Lord wills, we're going to do that. Now, that's not a formulaic phrase, okay? That isn't something that we just have to say before every time we say we make a plan. What he's saying there is, you need to factor the things of God in as you're making your plans. Because that is what's going to be critical to the ultimate outcome of your life. Now, why do you need to factor God in all the time? Okay, because he's there all the time, right? And because we just don't know what this life has to hold. And there's so many unknown things. And people seem to think like, you know, well, we'll work out this God thing later. You know, I got things to do right now. But his attitude here is, life is kind of short. Now, this whole vapor thing I thought was kind of interesting, because even back in Job, when Job was talking to his friends, one of the statements that he made was, when a cloud vanishes, it's gone, and so as he goes down to Sheol, does not come up. Now, what does he mean by going down to Sheol? Dying, right? One who dies, they're gone. From this world, anyway, right? We don't get too many... Yeah, video games have spoiled a lot of the younger generation. What happens in a if you're old enough and you don't know what I mean, don't worry about it, but if you're in a first-person shooter game and you get shot, what happens? You respawn. Okay, that is so cool. Okay, and then you just keep playing. Oh, you might lose some points or whatever, but okay. How's that work in real life? Nah, it doesn't work so well in real life, does it? Proverbs 27, verse 1, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. I've been thinking a lot about this one in my job, especially because I keep lists. People know me. I'm an engineer. I'm very meticulous about things. I keep lists of what I want to do every day. It's depressing because I have a list that I'll put together in the morning, and it says, here's the five things I want to make sure I get done today. A few weeks ago, I found something to make me happier. As things interrupt me and I don't get to those five things, whatever I do, I put it on my list. So at the end of the day, when I look at it, I'll have some things checked off that I've actually accomplished, right? Is that sad or what? But that's the way life is sometimes, right? We make plans and sometimes we get there and sometimes we don't. And we just can't boast about our lives and about tomorrow because we have no idea what tomorrow is going to bring. From life to death. It's just the way it is. And unless we understand that, then our attitude won't be right before God as we start looking at the things to do. Psalms 39, verses 5 through 6. Behold, you've made my days as handbreadths, and my lifetime is nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. Isn't that one of the kind of themes in Proverbs as well? The one man gathers everything together as his riches, and then what happens? He dies, and his worthless son gets them. Well, we've seen that happen a lot in the news, right? You amass the riches, and then who gets them? And it's out of your control. So there's a lot to life that just, as we look at it, it makes sense, but isn't it easy to just get caught up in it? And so he's saying, as you're making these plans, go ahead and make the plans. We have to plan. God doesn't want us to just give up on everything. That's not the idea either, is it? So he wants us to plan for tomorrow. But he says, you just got to be careful how you do it. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll also do this or that. And that's really what he's talking about, is more your attitude of, you know what, I got diverted. Maybe I helped somebody else. I didn't get my list done, but maybe I helped somebody else. And that's got to be good enough for the day. Worrying about it's not going to help. My list is still there tomorrow. We'll work on it tomorrow. But the scary one is that last verse. First, he wants us to change our attitude about things. But then he wants us to keep in mind, therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Now, how does that fit in with these verses? We use this standalone quite a bit. But he's not just making this as an oddball statement stuck here in the middle of everything. It's attached to what came before. What does he mean by that? Okay.
I think as we go about our lives and we think about our own plans and our own aspirations, we need to make sure that we don't neglect the good things that God would rather have us do in our day-to-day life. Kind of like you talked about your list. You got your things that you want to accomplish, but if you see your brother in need or you see some other opportunity to do good, do that. Forget about your own aspirations.
I think that's a good part of it, is we make our plans, but when the Lord was talking about the judgment scene there in Matthew 25, when he was talking to those and he said, to depart from me. What was one of the things he said? He said, I was hungry and you didn't feed me. I was naked and you didn't clothe me. And what was their reply? We didn't see any of that. Oh, but the judgment after that was, because you didn't do it to the least of these, you didn't do it for me. So, obviously, there were opportunities that they had that they missed. That's another scary one. Because not only is James saying that we have to be careful what we do, what's he also saying? Be careful about what you don't do. Okay, that's just not fair, is it? I mean, it's, we have to worry about not only what we're doing, but what we're not doing. But that's what he's asking us in our lives, is to be deliberate, to be thoughtful, to pay attention to what's around us, and in our plans, keep God in mind. I saw. Yes.
Yeah, there's a saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and it is quite true. Many times we say, well, yeah, no, I need to do that, I need to do this. Yes, I need to obey the gospel. Today is the day of salvation, 2 Corinthians 6:2, but tomorrow, I'll do it tomorrow, and I may not come.
Yeah, and part of the difficulty that we have is the balance. And I think that's what God's asking us to do, is understand the balance. Because we can get so wrapped up in trying to do things for others that we neglect. We can get so wrapped up in ourselves that we neglect for others. It's just, there's too much to do. Another common conversation that Debbie and I have is that it's just not fair that everybody has 24 hours in a day. There are a lot of people who waste their hours. I want some of those because I never finish what I've got to do, right? And so it would be nice if I had some extra time. But guess what? God's given each of us 24 hours. We just do the best we can with what we have. Oh. That's a really good question. And I'll tell you, you got to follow your conscience on that one. The SAPD says it's not a good idea to give them money. There's a whole bunch of them that are just professional collectors. Maybe there's some legit ones out there. Me personally, I've gotten involved through some of the stuff we have at work and whatnot of being able to donate to some places that help take care of those people. There are other people who put packages of things together to hand out rather than money. A number of ways you can handle it. Part of the other thing that bothers us is the responsibility that we have for doing handling what God has given us correctly. But on the other hand, mercy triumphs in many cases. So I don't have a pat answer for you. And I think that a lot of people are going to have to think about it and think about your conscience and what you want to do there. But I also don't think there's necessarily much of a wrong answer as long as you've thought it through. And that's not the only place that you're going to wind up with people that need help. And that's an issue that we deal with. There's family times when we need to help families. And there are a number of those in this congregation who are having to help support other people in their family. That's part of the obligation that we have. There are times when we see others that need a help or a loan or something, whether it's money or whether it's our time to help them out with something. Then those are the things we just need to be aware of and figure out where we fit in this community of ourselves that we can help each other. And then, as we look outside, it's to those first in the household of God, but then we see others outside, too, that we need to help. So, no pat answers, but this one's one that we really have to be careful of, right? If you know something's right to do, be careful before you turn away and not do it. Okay, any questions on that section then? It continues on this theme of wealth for the next few verses, and beginning in chapter 5, where it says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. And you have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you." He's got a therefore, but we're going to start there and just talk about that first part. Because he starts out with saying, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl." Okay, somebody give me a definition of rich. Okay. Good definition there. Anything else? Okay, pretty much. Yeah. When it compared, you know, we look around at the celebrities around us and other people who are making, you know, bazillions of dollars playing sports and things like that. And we might, if we compare ourselves to them, we don't think of ourselves as being rich, do we? Some of us have the idea that rich is being able to do whatever you want. You know, that's the real rich. There's even TV shows, right? Anybody, what was it? Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous or something like that. And they would show these, you know, gigantic zillion-room houses on the beachfront. And I don't know why you'd want more rooms than you could go to in a year, but Webster has a good definition. Having abundant possessions and especially material wealth. Now, as Rob was pointing out, if we compare ourselves to probably 95% of the rest of the world, how would we fit on that definition scale? Pretty well rich. I've told the story before about my uncle who discovered when he was in seminary, they were talking about sociology and wealth distribution in the U.S. and gave the county, Crenshaw County, Alabama, as the example of the poorest county at the time in the U.S., and that almost everyone there was below the poverty line. And it was just very surprising for him, because that's where he grew up. He told my dad when he came found that out, he said, "I never knew we were poor. You know, they got one pair of shoes a year, they had food on the table, and they went to school. They didn't know they were poor." And yet we've got a little very different view of that now, don't we? And I think part of the thing that we have to worry about is we don't consider ourselves rich, and yet we are. And we're so blessed in many ways. All of us are. Spoiled is probably another good word for it. Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a game that you can chase forever, is it not? There's only one wealthiest person in the world somewhere, probably in China at this point, I don't know. But you know, there's a lot of people that are on that path to try to pass them. It's not me. we're not going to get to that level, and yet I do consider myself extremely well blessed by God. Now, the question is, what do we do with it? What are the dangers of this wealth that we have? What's James talking about here? David?
Greed.
Okay, greed definitely is a danger, and definitely one of those things that is talked about in a number of places in the Bible. Absolutely. And so, you know, what we have, a recognition of where it comes from, is probably one of the first things. Yeah. I'm sorry? Okay, absolutely. And that's a problem. Sometimes the more we have, the more comfortable we are, then we begin to lose sight of it. In Proverbs, there's a proverb of Agur that I've always loved, right? He says, give me neither poverty nor riches, because if I've got poverty, then I'm tempted to steal, which is not what I should do. And if I've got riches, what happens? I have no need of God. And so he says, as in a lot of things, as I've begun to notice as I grow older, is that we've got to find that balance, that middle line somewhere that says, neither poverty nor riches. I've got enough that I'm not tempted to steal. I don't have so much that I forget God. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Greed can quite often be justified by ourselves internally. And I think that's one of the things that he talks about there. Oh, I think that can absolutely be a danger. A very good point there. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't write a check occasionally to help others, but that's, again, part of that balance is where should we be doing. Diane, I think you had your hand. Okay. So the first thing he talks about there is how they got their wealth, right? Yeah, and that's one extreme of it, but we can go, you know, all kinds of extremes on this as we look at it for this balance that we're looking. And James is talking here. First, he says, how do these people get it? What are some of the things that he accused them of? He said, the people that mowed your field, what happened to them? You didn't get paid, right? You didn't pay them. So part of it was how they got what they got. they, in pursuit of that, they were willing to make some compromises with integrity and with themselves and before God. And if we make those kind of compromises, I think that's what James is talking about, then you're headed down the wrong road. But then there's another aspect of it, and that is not only how you get it, but how you spend it. If you got it fully in a, you know, being cognizant of other people, totally fair and all that kind of stuff, and all you did was pile it up, is that the way God wants us to use his blessings either? That's just as wrong. So he's talking about both of these aspects. He says, what's the danger of wealth? Well, the danger is the pursuit of it is what can lead you to compromises. And the having of it is what can lead you to hoarding or not doing what you need to do with the blessings God has given you. And he says, you know, it doesn't make sense there too as much because that was an agricultural society. He says that your riches have rotted. Back then, riches were quite often what they had in their barns and what they had stored away. Was it possible for, you know, maybe a warehouse full of grain or whatever else to be destroyed? Absolutely. I have some fond memories of some work that I did in the citrus industry. And we worked with these things that took the citrus peel. I don't know if you ever know it or not, but when they juice the oranges, they take the peel and turn it into cattle feed. But they have to get the moisture level just right when they're drying it out. Because if it's just a little too wet and they put it in these giant barns, it catches on fire all by itself. It's what's called an exothermic reaction. It builds up heat, catches on fire. And I've got a picture of this pile out in this field smoldering. Looks like the fields of Gehenna. It was exactly what happened. This huge barn full of this stuff just caught fire. And the only thing they could do was bulldoze it out in this field to kind of let it go burn out. So he's talking about that was wealth. You know, that was somebody's a lot of you know, money there. And it just ruined. It spoiled. Now, he's talking about gold and silver rusting. That doesn't happen. But it's metaphorical, right? What's he mean by that? It deteriorates. It's not useful anymore. What's that?
It goes to waste.
And that's really what he's talking about. So even when he uses that something, everybody, you know, that you kind of is a shocking statement there, gold and silver rusting, that doesn't happen. Oh, no, what he means is it's just going to waste. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10, we're all familiar with this passage. It's the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. It's not money itself, is it? Do we know of rich people in the Bible? Lots of them. But you look at the lives that they led, how they got their money and how they spent their money, and it puts a whole different light on it. Some longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. It really is true, and they've done studies on it. Does wealth equal happiness? Not even close. Not even close. There's a lot of people who really don't have much that are quite happy. A lot of people who have a lot that are very unhappy. And that's what James is wanting to get across. We have to be careful with that. And that was as much a problem back then as it was today. One more. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Right? So the question is where is your treasure? And some, the treasure is located in the bank. Or if they don't trust banks, it's buried somewhere in a field, right? And yet he's saying, where your treasure is, there's your heart. Now, I think there's kind of an interesting thing about that. That's a chicken and egg, isn't it? Where your heart is, that's where you'll lay up your treasure. And if your heart is not in the right place, you're going to be laying up your treasure wrong. So, but what he's saying here is we were talking a little earlier about judging brothers and knowing the heart. We do have clues. We may not be able to see in a heart completely. But what did Jesus say about how we would know other people? By their fruits, you will know them. So there's how we can make judgments. And I think that is what he's referring to here. Can you kind of get an idea about somebody's heart by where they're laying up their treasure? Yeah? That's one of the signs that he's giving us here. You want to be able to tell how somebody's heart is. Look at where they're laying up their treasure. What's important to them? And that's what's going to come out. Okay, so we got some closing exhortations. We'll have to start with those next week. That'll be the last week that we'll kind of go through the verses there. It's quite a bit. Read through it. And then we're going to probably take a week and do just a quick overview of my favorite verses in James. See you next week.